Have you ever thought about what really goes into supporting digital scholarship? Well, some may say it takes a village, but here at the University of Illinois, it's bigger than that. It takes a campus. The Scholarly Commons will be interviewing experts across campus about all the new and exciting things that are happening to support digital scholarship. We will sit down with a specialist to learn about what they do, how they do it, and why they got started working in their field. Hear what we mean when we say it takes a campus to do what we do.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of It Takes a Campus. My name is Ben, and I am currently a graduate assistant at the Scholarly Commons, and today I'm joined with Dr. Ted Underwood, who is a professor at the Ice School here at the University of Illinois. Dr. Underwood, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for taking time to talk to me today.
Hi, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to get started by asking how you got started integrating digital methods into your research, since, as I understand it, your formal academic background is in English literature.
Right. It seems like a bit of an unusual turn, but it actually has a long history. Back in the 1990s, when I was in grad school, it was already beginning to be clear that there were going to be opportunities as our digital libraries got bigger to pose questions about the evolution of ideas, the development of literary form. And I tried to do that a bit in the 90s using the very limited collections of texts we had then. And I published an article. But, I didn't go much further with it because the collections were very limited. And also, it wasn't easy to do things then. So, fast forward to 2009. And John Unsworth, then dean of what was called the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences here at Illinois, got in touch with me and drew me into a project. And I discovered, wow, we have Google Books now, first of all. And then secondarily, and I think just as importantly, it's easy to learn stuff now. Like, you can just go on the web and search how to do something and sort of teach yourself. It did help that I had a little bit of programming background from the 80s, but that was pretty dusty by that point. But, it's just things had gotten to where we had the resources and it was easy to teach yourself how to do stuff.
Great. So I'm going to ask you possibly an annoying question.
Go for it.
Which I think every person who works in the digital humanities inevitably has to answer at some point. It's a question that often comes up, which is how you define the digital humanities, and to what extent does that definition matter? Because everybody seems to have their own definition, and inevitably it leads to perhaps interesting conversations. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that conversation.
Yeah, thank you. It's not an annoying question. It's a inevitable and important question, I think, actually, even though it's true that people try to avoid it because, as you say, it's a complex term, a term that people use in different ways. And the slipperiness of the term does generate sometimes friction. But I don't think that is an accident, or something that we can sort of step around. It is inherent to the term, and it's not accidental. The term is deliberately vague, digital humanities. It could encompass, say, using humanistic methods to study podcasts or blog posts or, digital media generally, using traditional humanistic methods, say, to study those things. Or it could mean using digital methods, whatever those are, maybe computational methods, statistics, what have you, to study podcasts, but perhaps also printed books, perhaps movies from the 1950s. So digital methods to study more traditional media, or, it could be the way scholarship is produced. It could be digital humanities is whatever you're doing. If you put it on the web, it's digital humanities. And that's a valid way of using the term too. So there's a lot of looseness there. And I don't think it's an accident. I think it is deliberate vagueness that's constructed in order to create a concept that is loose enough to be welcoming, to welcome lots of different people. Because there's a real danger, that there's a lot of tension at this intersection between the traditions of the humanities and computational media, computational methods. So if there's a lot of risk that if you say specifically computational humanities or humanities using numbers, some people will be like, whoa, that is not what I signed up for. Get out of here. You know, that's a real risk. Conversely, if you say, okay, we're going to study digital media, some people will say, well, I'm actually more interested in the 20th century or the 19th century. And I'm interested in history. That's what the humanities mean to me. So there's these tensions there, and we've tried to bridge them by constructing a term that is deliberately baggy. And that works somewhat. It's worked to sort of create a broad community of people and a lively conversation. But we shouldn't be surprised when then that dissolves and breaks apart. It was the instability was built into that term from the beginning. So it does matter. It does matter that we understand the term, but you know, we shouldn't be surprised that it doesn't come down to a crisp definition.
Yeah, great. And that kind of leads me to my next question, because on our previous episode, we had Spencer Corrales, who is the digital humanities librarian here at the University of Illinois. And they talked about some of this tension, particularly between research that is published in interactive digital format, such as on a platform like Scalar or Omeka, versus using digital methods in support of a more traditional scholarly communication, like a journal article or a monograph.
Yep.
Do you agree that such a divide exists, and what your thoughts are about that, and are there ways that perhaps they could work better in tandem together, or is it perhaps to be expected, at least, that there might be somewhat of a divide there within digital humanities umbrella?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that a divide exists there. It's not a crisp one, because, I mean, even if your research is setting out to produce basically articles and books, if you're doing that using digital methods, you're going to have data or code that needs to be preserved, probably online. And you're probably also going to, you know, visualizations. So the lines between sort of traditional scholarly formats and new platforms do get blurry. But I do agree that there are some people in digital humanities for whom stretching the boundaries of the publication format and of what counts as scholarship to include maybe, you know, digital editing, for instance, rather than thesis-driven argument. There are people for whom that's central. And then there are other people who maybe, you know, welcome digital editing, but they're primarily interested in producing new arguments, argument-driven scholarship. And there's no necessary conflict between those things, but they rub up against the external world in different places. They conflict with existing institutions in different places. So, for instance, if you're doing if you're building digital exhibitions on Omeka, then it's very important to redefine what counts as scholarship in terms of sort of promotion and tenure review, because the role of editing and of building collections is often ambiguous, at least at research universities. On the other hand, you know, so that's then becomes the point of friction between digital humanities and the rest of the world. Whereas if you're doing, say, like quantitative scholarship, but scholarship that's ultimately going to produce an article, then the point of friction might be, say, like, how do we go about training students to do this, because it's not in the curriculum. So and frankly, ideally, it would require a sequence of 3 or 4 courses really to prepare students to do that. Statistics programming, you know, it can't easily be done in 1 or 2 courses. So There's it's not that those two things are in conflict, but that they have sort of different battles to fight. And I do think that sometimes produces a conflict in the sense that, you know, people are like, hey, we need some help over here. You know, that's where the conflict comes from.
Yeah. And that leads me to a follow-up question, which is, as a, you know, a professor who teaches courses, in my experience, there is definitely a certain challenge in digital humanities of training students in digital methods that Typically, it seems like digital humanities students come from a humanities background as opposed to from a computer science background, typically, anyways. And so oftentimes there can be quite a learning curve for students. And oftentimes they can be scared away by the challenges involved. So how do you deal with that? And what are ways we could perhaps do better at that?
Yeah, I don't think we have a good solution there yet, actually. That is definitely the case. And the I've been evolving, and I'll tell you the direction I've been evolving on that, and I think I'm still evolving. So like 10 years ago or 9 years ago, back in 2011, 2012, I had the idea that it would be possible to do all of this in a course in the English department, which is where I was located then. And maybe we'd have a graduate course in the English department where it would be something like digital humanities or digital methods in literary study. And we'd explore the controversies about the nature of digital humanities, and then maybe along the way introduce students to some programming and statistics. And that is so impossible. That's now ludicrous, right? Like you that's actually like five courses that you're trying to compress into one. But it seemed necessary, and in some ways it was necessary at the time, because you couldn't assume that students, say, in an English department were going to expect to have to take three or four courses in this area or be willing to, because it was still very new and controversial. So you were going to get one course. Realistically, that was going to be the curriculum. So there were just a limit on what you could actually do. You could not really teach computational methods in a course like that. And I've dealt with that partly by expanding my role in the university, where now I'm teaching in School of Information Sciences, where there is a bigger DH curriculum and there are more students who are likely to have taken courses in programming or data science and be able to maybe take a more advanced course where we apply that to, say, look at unstructured data, look at text or images. But it is still definitely a challenge. Because realistically, like I say, it actually would be a three or four course sequence, not a two course sequence. And so there's still considerable risk of rushing things. And I don't think that I'm avoiding that successfully yet, to be honest with you. It's going to be, it's sort of like a co-evolution between the way we teach this and the way that the curricular institutions around us sort of frame the topic and what they suggest is possible. There's another approach, I should say. There is another way to go about this, which is very popular, and I just don't think it works either, which is to try to fit it all into one course by basically ditching the programming part and say, there are some user-friendly tools out there. We can use those. Like Voyant is one tool, a very good. It's about as good as can be done in that space of doing sort of text analysis in your browser on the web. There are some other similar tools that promise to be user-friendly, and they are to a certain point, but then you rapidly will run up against the limits of what you can actually do in those, say, graphical user interfaces. So if we do it that way, we can squeeze it into one course or two courses maybe, but then where do students go from there is what I'm not certain. So it's that is a really big challenge. But I think ideally, my view would be it means what we need to do is maybe define a little better a, say, three-course sequence in this space.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've had to deal with in my experience, because for listeners who don't know me, I was previously the technician for the Irish Center at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, which that's the Digital Humanities Center there. And we have a digital humanities minor there. And I was actually the first student to receive that minor. But okay. We, in working on the curriculum after I received that minor, a big challenge we've had to deal with is do students actually need to have programming experience to receive that minor? And I did, but many students have some hesitation about that. And it seems like to a certain extent, there's a I think there's a fear, at least, of those who design curriculum that if you have too much programming involved, you're going to scare students away. And
yeah.
I don't really have a good answer for that, but it's a definite challenge.
I don't either. I mean, but here's what I see as likely to happen is, so we can build programs in the humanities that don't have programming as part of them. And that can be a valid thing. I'm not against doing that. But if we do that, there will also be programs that arise in the social sciences and in information science and in computer science, for that matter. They're beginning to happen in departments of computer science already that use more flexible and adventurous kinds of computation than you can easily fit into a graphical tool. Because, you know, social scientists are used to using statistics, and departments of information science and computer science exist also. So it's like, if we don't do it, they definitely will, because they can, you know, and humanities materials, movies, books, are fascinating. They're really appealing. So departments of computer science will definitely go for that. They're not going to wait for us to do it. So it's, you know, it's fine that we could do it both ways, but the computational way is gonna happen somewhere. It's just a question of where.
And do you think it's better off happening from like the end of the humanities going to the computer, or the other way, or do you think that?
I would love them to be a bridge. I would love it to be a bridge, and I think it can be. I mean, in some ways, that's the promise of information science as a place, is that you can have a single institution where really both of those perspectives are represented and are joining hands and collaborating. It can work, you know, it can work across campus too. If you've got a humanist in a English department or history department collaborating with someone in computer science, that can also work. But I like the feeling of a school where you've got people from a lot of different disciplinary backgrounds collaborating. So yeah, I hope we're able to hold that all together. But it's, you know, just as with the term digital humanities itself, you end up describing a very big arch or bridge that's fragile at lots of points, and it's hard to hold together.
Yeah, as we've been talking, I realize we haven't really had a whole lot of opportunity for you to talk about your particular research interests. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about some of what the computational work you've done in your research.
Sure. I mean,
that's a big question. So,
I mean, it varies. I'll organize it into two heads: sort of things I've done and things that I, sort of maybe looking forward, things that I think are getting exciting. But a lot of what I've done is to use large digital libraries to pose questions about long timelines in literary history. So, you know, how has the pace of narration changed? How much time passes in a typical page of a novel? Are we talking about a week of fictional time that passes in each page of reading, or is it a day, or is it sometimes increasingly in recent years it's more like 2 minutes per page? The pace has slowed down, and when that slowdown happened is not something we had a good picture of. A lot of literary critics, for instance, thought that happened at the beginning of the 20th century with modernism. And now that we have a big picture, we can see it was actually much more gradual. And similar sorts of questions about concreteness, the development of concreteness in fiction. But really, it's, you know, all of these things come together in a way to make a bigger story about literary history and the study of literature, which is, to a large extent, our idea of what literature is for has been shaped by certain aspects of literature that only developed very recently, like this emphasis on concrete particulars and brief sort of fragmentary moments that we now think is sort of that experiential vividness and particularity is crucial to the mission of literature, so much so that it shaped the way we think we ought to be reading and interpreting literature. But it's actually, if you look at the big picture, you can see where we got that. It's a long story, a gradual story. And in fact, sort of our idea that you can't use big numbers and, you know, panoramas to understand literature is a product of a history that, if you back up, we can actually see the panorama that generated that. So that's the story I've been telling. But I think in years to come, I'm interested in looking at not just at sort of, big digital libraries and long surveys across long timelines, but I'm getting increasingly interested in understanding literature in detail, like how plot works, how suspense works. And I think it's going, the nature of machine learning and of computation is evolving so rapidly that it's going to become increasingly possible for us to pose some questions that seem like less social science-y, more interpretive, using machine learning.
Yeah, I've seen arguments, and this is largely in a non-academic context, so take this kind of with a grain of salt, but that like plots are becoming increasingly complex over time in media in general. At least I think the argument was particularly for TV shows, that like it used to be TV shows were just linear, like beginning to end, and nowadays you have a lot of like not just time travel, but flashbacks and nonlinear storytelling. So I'd be interested in questions like that about like ways of seeing how the way narrative is constructed is changing, because the conventional wisdom oftentimes is like people are getting dumb and like which I don't agree with, but
it's pretty clear. I think there's actually some agreement that TV has gotten more adventurous for a lot. I mean, one thing, there's a classic thesis, and I don't know who to attribute it to, but just the development of the VCR or DVR meant that you could return and pay attention to the texture of television. You could slow down and get the joke. Whereas if it's broadcast television in the 1970s, it's gone. you can't return to it. So that I think we know, but there are going to be all kinds of other questions. There's some good work that's come out recently in the journal Cultural Analytics studying the sitcom using face recognition, and they're like, which characters get attention, when in the plot, when in the arc of the sitcom do they get attention, and we're going to be able to study that kind of formal architecture of TV genres as well as literary genres in new ways, I think. Yeah,
that's exciting. And that leads me to the last formal question I had prepared, which is, and you addressed this already, but maybe perhaps
there's more to say.
Big picture. I'm sure there's always more to say.
Yeah.
And the question is, what do you see as the future of data science in the humanities?
Yeah, I see it as being really capacious, really. So, the kind of thing I've done, like where it's explicitly quantitative and it's about big historical stories, that's never going to be everything the humanities are about, because we're also about individuals, and that's valid. We're about individual stories. But I think what's happening now, the line between data science and machine learning, or to use the term that's sometimes used, artificial intelligence, I kind of prefer machine learning, but it's different sides of the same coin. That is a very blurry continuum. So and that means that we are not just going to be studying culture in a kind of large-scale social science-y way, but we're going to be able to, for instance, do the things that large language models do, where you can give them the beginning of a story and then they can continue it. Like, okay, if that's how the story begins in that style, then this would be a plausible next paragraph. Or they can do something similar to that with images. And that means we can begin to pose questions about the sort of the frame-to-frame movement of a video, or the paragraph-to-paragraph movement of a story, where we start to ask questions about, for instance, what makes some stories more predictable than others? Like, is it easier to predict where this plot is going to go? Or we could pose questions about, like, where could this story have alternatively gone? Where could it plausibly have gone? Suppose it's written in the 1870s. What are the plausible alternative endings for this story? What about if we move it forward a decade? We're getting models that are good enough to be able to pose that kind of question, like what could have happened in the story under alternate circumstances. And that's going to open up just a huge range of questions that are not limited to the kinds of questions we think of as appropriate for data science or social science. They're more, to be honest, they're akin to creative questions. One of the things about these generative models of images or of text, is they're doing something like generating the artwork. Now, I don't think that means that we're going to have robots write all our novels for us. They're not that good. And the arc of a whole plot is something they still struggle with. And I'm not sure we want that anyway, actually. I think it's more fun. People enjoy fan fiction because they enjoy going back and forth with a story world, right? They enjoy participation. But it does mean that the line between what we think of as analytical or critical tasks and what we think of as creative play could get really blurry. And that to me suggests that the future of data science and the humanities is not something that we're going to want to keep walled out because it's too much like social science. It actually could be really central to what we think of as things like play that are central to the purpose of the humanities. But for that to happen, it's going to need to become kind of like a lingua franca that we're more comfortable with than we are right now. And I think that will happen, actually, because the opportunities are just too huge. But how it will happen, where that happens in the curriculum, remains a bit of a mystery.
Yeah, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a certain level of, I think, like fear out in the world about like artificial intelligence or machine learning.
You are not wrong.
Yeah.
You are not wrong.
I mean, certainly more in like the context of facial recognition and the use of like surveillance or what have you.
And social media and big tech corporations. These kinds of fear are all interwoven, yes.
Yeah, so I imagine that bleeds into the academy and hesitation people might have about.
And it doesn't just bleed into the academy. A lot of that is sort of generated in the academy, and it's. I mean, if I'm going to be completely candid about that, partly that's a reflection of a emerging competition between universities and tech companies, which are both like there's this space which is like intellectual institutions in society, which universities have had kind of a monopoly there. Like, oh, if there's going to be research in computer science, we're going to be doing it. Now the tech companies are kind of claiming to be the leading edge of CS research, which does not make universities comfortable. And so that's part of the anxiety is fueled by just sort of general social things with social media and fears of surveillance. But within the academic context, we also have to be candid that like, Google is a competitor for universities, and it's not surprising that university professors like myself are real wary of it. So, but I think it's also valid, right? That should, to be sure, if the steam engine was socially disruptive and was a problem and magnified social problems and was not handled well. And is machine learning going to do all those things too? Magnify social problems, increase concentration of power, not be handled well, need kinds of regulation that we don't yet have? Yes. I mean, all of that will be true for sure. So it's going to be there. And at the same time, I also think everything that I said earlier is true, that it can like magnify human creativity and become a way of we understand human creativity and be a kind of collaborative space for human creativity. So it's not an either or, but it means that there's a really interesting, complex struggle and conversation that plays out there.
Yeah, it almost seems like perhaps the attitude is that if we don't use it or don't acknowledge it, it doesn't exist, or we don't have to worry about it then. Or maybe that's oversimplifying it, but we're better off at least like, claiming it or taking ownership of it at least figuring out how it works. So like,
yeah, that for sure. Like, yeah. I mean, I think everyone would agree about that it's a real bad idea for people not to understand how machine learning works. That I think we can all agree about that. Where to go next is sort of, is where things get a little complicated, but I'm not really sure yet that we have like that we have a policy disagreement about like how should machine learning be regulated. I think generally speaking, a lot of when the conversation actually gets that concrete, there's often a lot of agreement. But it's before we get to that level, when we're talking about like what attitude should we adopt to machine learning, before it really gets to the concrete level of what should we do, then there's a lot of tension because people have very different attitudes and very different, I mean, honestly, it's an emotional thing. Like, how do we, I have, when I look at sort of a big new language model, I have a feeling of excitement and joy and like, it's spring and there's going to be new flowers coming up and I don't know what they are. But people, I know that people do not have that feeling when they look at a large language model. And I understand that. But it's not, I don't think that's purely like an intellectual debate where it's before, it's even sort of like before we've gotten to the stage of framing an intellectual debate about it. It's that people just have at this stage very different kind of, I guess the technical term would be priors or instincts. Yeah.
Perhaps a gut reaction of some sort or...
Gut reaction. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I understand. I do understand where the other gut reaction is coming from because big tech companies are scary, legit scary. And also the ways governments can use machine learning and will use machine learning, I think, are highly scary. So that's all true. It's just holding, you know, where we, how we hold those things in tension, right? Because it's, there's always a dark and a bright side to everything, including like, you know, the human body, right? It has problems. So, but it's how you hold those things in tension that remains to be seen.
Right. The title of our podcast is It Takes a Campus. So I feel like I should ask something about like the, I guess the campus environment in which you operate, because at least speaking as someone who came from another university that had DH in various forms,
yeah.
University of Illinois is so big that it almost inevitably becomes in some sense siloed, for lack of a better way of putting it. And maybe that's not accurate. I don't know.
It's accurate.
Still fairly new. Yeah. but it feels like that's a definite issue for digital humanities, is there's a certain level of siloing that occurs. And how do we deal with that?
Yeah. So there's siloing within sort of a university from other universities. And then there's different communities within the campus. The thing I like to say about the University of Illinois is that it's like a Kafka novel in that, or a short story by Kafka, in that somewhere on campus there's an amazing resource meant for you and you alone, but you may or may not ever discover the door where it's hidden behind. So there's so much going on here, but that means that the people are not necessarily always in communication. I think that is a challenge for DH. It's a, you know, there are connections between, in particular, I would say, the iSchool and HRI, which has its own Humanities Research Institute, if I'm getting the acronym right. It used to be IPRH, which is sort of on a different part of campus. But we're both doing digital humanities in different ways and in some communication with each other. And then there's communication with the outside world, which I think is also important. And I think this program, Training in Digital Methods for Humanists, that's centered at HRI, has done a bit to encourage people to go out to, you know, summer institutes, say, where they can be in communication with people at other universities. And I do think that's important, because otherwise you fall behind, honestly. And it's particularly challenging for all universities, not just for Illinois right now, because there's not a lot of hiring happening in the humanities. So it is easy to fall behind, actually, if we don't consciously refresh our experience. I do think that's a challenge, but I'm optimistic that we'll build the needed bridges.
Yeah, well, great. Well, that's largely what I had prepared today, but I want to give you the opportunity to speak to anything you feel like we should have talked about. I mean, that's a pretty open door, so...
No, those were great questions, actually. And I got a chance to go off on how large language models are like the approach of spring with unknown flowers coming up. That's what I wanted to say. So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you got the opportunity to say that. Yeah. It's not an army from Mordor.
It's also an army from Mordor, but, it's both things.
Yeah, well, the world is complex.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really enjoyed our conversation, I look forward to talking to you more in class later. Full disclosure to the podcast, Dr. Underwood is currently my professor for Data Science and the Humanities course.
It's fair to disclose.
Yes.
it's been a pleasure talking to you too.
Yes. Yep. And I will talk to you again later.
It Takes a Campus is a podcast brought to you by the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's Scholarly Commons, located in the main library. If you want more from us, be sure to check out our blog, Commons Knowledge, at publish.illinois.edu/commonsknowledge, and follow us on Twitter at Schol Commons. That's S-C-H-O-L Commons. The opening and closing song is Tranquility Base by AAA Alto. You can find their album Bright Colors in the Free Music Archive by searching for AAA Alto at freemusicarchive.org. Thanks for listening.